Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and 3 times best-selling author, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is with functional medicine expert Ari Whitten on eating for energy, how to beat fatigue, supercharge your mitochondria, and unlock all-day energy. We pack so much into today's episode. And if you are someone who struggles with fatigue, either chronic fatigue or just general low energy levels through stress, through life, or you're someone who's been either diagnosed with a form of adrenal fatigue, either self-diagnosed or with a professional, then today's episode is for you. We go through everything from rewiring your energy clock, how to look at your lifestyle, your sleep, your supplementation, and most importantly, your nutrition when it comes to increasing your energy levels throughout the day, whether that's to stay on top of adherence with a nutritional plan for weight loss, or whether it's just to improve your quality of life. This is one of these episodes that if you have any friends or family members who struggle with fatigue, either chronic fatigue or just general fatigue, I highly recommend that you pass on this podcast to them, or it would be greatly appreciated from my side, but even from them, to get the value that Ari is able to share in today's podcast. So without further ado, here is today's expert guest, functional medicine expert Ari Whitten, on eating for energy, how to beat fatigue, supercharge your mitochondria, and unlock all day energy. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Ari Whitten. Ari is a functional medicine expert and founder of The Energy Blueprint. He's also the author of the highly anticipated forthcoming book, Eat for Energy, How to Beat Fatigue, Supercharge Your Mitochondria, and Unlock All-Day Energy. Ari is an energy and fatigue specialist who focuses on taking an evidence-based approach to energy enhancement. He has been studying nutrition and holistic health for over 2 decades and has a Bachelor's of Science from the San Diego State University in Kinesiology. He also has a background in exercise physiology and fitness and holds 2 advanced certifications from the National Academy of Sports Medicine as a corrective exercise specialist and performance enhancement specialist. In addition, he recently completed the 3 years of coursework for his PhD in clinical psychology and education, which rounds out all aspects, nutrition, fitness, and psychology of his approach to optimal health. For the last 6 years, he's been working with many of the top scientists and physicians on the planet to develop the most comprehensive program in the world on the science of overcoming fatigue and increasing energy, the Energy Blueprint. I'm looking forward to talking all things nutrition, energy, and combating fatigue in today's episode. Ari, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian. A pleasure.
Ari, I want to jump into your backstory before we start to unpack kind of your specialty and the new book in particular. But I know from reading your history, you were bedridden and you had your own health crisis. So talk to us a little bit about your backstory and kind of what got you interested in the world you're in now when it comes to specializing in enhancing energy for people.
Yeah, well, for many years, I was a fitness guy. Fitness was my passion and my world was really body composition. I was an aspiring bodybuilder for, you know, most of my youth. And my older brother was a bodybuilder who was being mentored by professional bodybuilders. And he was a personal trainer. And so from a very young age, from 12, 13 years old, I was in that world. And I, you know, like any good little brother, I wanted to be like big brother. And so, you know, the bodybuilding kind of became my world, and I was, I would say, somewhat gifted for it and obsessed with it. And so I was reading, you know, college level nutrition and exercise physiology textbooks by the time I was 14, 15 years old. And I really went very deep into that for well over a decade. And then in my mid-20s, something happened that really shifted things for me. And that was I got mononucleosis from Epstein-Barr virus. This is also called, depending on which country you're in, I know you're in Ireland. I don't know what they call it there, probably either glandular fever or the kissing disease. It goes by either one of those names in most countries, or in the U.S., mononucleosis. I think the other names make more sense than the U.S. names, quite frankly, but it hit me quite severely. It took a long time to even get a diagnosis. I was put on penicillin treatments, which did nothing because they thought it was strep throat. It took probably 6 weeks before the blood tests even came back showing massively, you know, sky-high titer levels for antibodies for Epstein-Barr virus. And by that time, I had already lost 35, 40 pounds from basically not being able to eat anything because the back of my throat, my tonsils, were like 2 giant golf balls of pus. And it was incredibly painful to consume any food or to swallow. So I was living off basically broth for about over a month. And then I subsequently dealt with severe chronic fatigue for almost a year. And I really watched kind of my whole life fall apart during this time. My relationship with my girlfriend, my relationship with friends. I was in school at the time. I was also doing a job, a very hard manual labor job. And my brain wasn't working. My body wasn't working. Everything was just kind of falling apart around me. And it was this massive experience of realizing that this thing that I had taken for granted my whole life up until then, being a fit, healthy guy, this thing of energy, really is at the core of having a good life. And that experience for me made me empathize with everybody who's dealing with chronic fatigue, and just watching really every aspect of your life, from relationships to pursuing your dreams in life. Everything just gets taken away from you when you don't have the physical energy to invest in those things. So for me, it was this really huge catalyst to shift away from kind of the fitness world and fat loss and muscle gain and bodybuilding world that I had been in for so long, and really become obsessed with the importance of energy levels. And in parallel and sort of in tandem with this process, I was seeing conventional doctors to get help who had basically nothing to offer people with chronic fatigue like me. And then I was seeing alternative practitioners and functional medicine doctors and people in the natural health realm. And everybody there was really obsessed with this whole thing of adrenal fatigue. And so I was diagnosed with adrenal fatigue, put on adrenal supplements, except I went and got a cortisol test to check my levels of cortisol and my adrenal function, and they were perfectly normal. And that caused me to then dig deeper into that whole thing. And ultimately, I spent about a year of my life pretty much full-time dedicated to analyzing the research around the relationship of the adrenals and the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis more broadly, and fatigue, ultimately discovering that the research really doesn't support the notion that adrenal fatigue is even a thing, let alone is the main cause of why people have chronic fatigue. So I was left kind of in this place of realizing conventional doctors don't have much to offer. The alternative natural health people who I generally identify with are obsessed with this whole hypothesis of adrenal fatigue that isn't really supported by science. And that, you know, that process, which took place over a couple of years, really made me go, well, maybe I need to go figure things out. Maybe I need to build out the real scientific framework of what is regulating and controlling human energy levels. So that's what I've been doing. That's what my brand, the Energy Blueprint, is all about. And that's what I've been doing for the last decade.
I've got so many follow-up questions. I just want, before we get into it though, can you define the difference between chronic fatigue and general fatigue for people? Because I think sometimes people can mislabel chronic fatigue versus general fatigue and tiredness. How would you define that in your words, Ari?
Yeah, well, they're really just words. And what has a specific definition, you could say myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME/CFS as it's often called, has some very specific diagnostic criteria, but and that's really the extreme of chronic fatigue syndrome. But even there isn't, we don't even have like specific tests that say, oh, you know, if you test positive on this blood biomarker, then that means you have ME/CFS. We're starting to learn, like basically that diagnosis is made based on a symptomatic diagnosis. So if you've had certain symptoms, one of the most important of which is something called post-exertional malaise, which basically means after doing a period of physical exertion, you might feel exhausted for 2 or 3 days in a very atypical way, in a way that's far beyond normal levels of tiredness after a workout that most people might experience. So But really what's going on is outside of, let's say, meeting the specific diagnostic criteria for that particular medical condition, which again is really just a collection of symptoms. I think a better way of thinking about it is fatigue and energy are a spectrum. On one end, we have high energy. On the other end, you have extremely low energy. And most people, most adults living in the Western world are somewhere in the middle of that spectrum, maybe a bit in the direction of lower energy or slightly higher energy. Very few people are on the upper bound of high energy levels outside of their youth, outside of the time when they're a kid. So I think that framework is much more insightful and instructive for really understanding what we're trying to do. We're trying to overcome fatigue, not by trying to identify some particular biochemical abnormality that's quote unquote the cause of one's chronic fatigue and taking a drug to fix it. We are trying to understand human physiology and what regulates human energy levels so we can move up on that spectrum from lower energy to higher energy.
With fatigue, then, what are some of the common misconceptions that you see? Do people, again, you mentioned adrenal fatigue there. It's one of those that I think people can attach to a label because it gives them confidence that, oh, well, this is what's wrong or this is what's causing this. And I totally get where that is. And we can confirmation bias and we close off our mind to all other ideas. But with fatigue, what are some of the misconceptions? Obviously, misdiagnosing adrenal fatigue for something else, chronic fatigue is one. But what are some of the other misconceptions you see? Is it not being aware of things like mitochondria or mitochondrial function, or is it something completely different that you regularly see, Ari?
Yeah, that's a good question. I almost don't know where to begin with that. There's so many layers to how I would answer that. But certainly adrenal fatigue is a big one. I would say, and that's interesting what you said there. I'll just comment briefly on it. There is a thing. For example, my older brother is a pain specialist and a chiropractor and a corrective exercise specialist, and he's often remarked on this interesting phenomenon that he sometimes experiences with some people who have various kinds of chronic pain. And, you know, my brother has a very, it's a focus on, you know, doing physical assessment, figuring out what's, you know, going on that's in the body that's causing it. And then, you know, kind of deducing, okay, well, if this is happening, if there's an imbalance here, let's work on this, this, and this. But for some people, they almost need a diagnosis to feel better. They need to be told you have blank. So some of these people might go to a conventional doctor and then they'll get an X-ray or an MRI and they'll say, oh, you've got this. And they won't be offered anything of actual practical value of how to fix it, but they'll just be given a diagnosis. And oftentimes people will feel much better just because they were given a diagnosis, even though there was nothing of practical value that came from that. But anyway, that's just a kind of an aside. That's just an interesting psychological phenomenon that you kind of alluded to there. Another area that I would say is a big misconception that's very counterproductive is stimulants and caffeine. And, you know, we often, most people often sort of look to stimulants or caffeine as an energy booster. But there's something really insidious going on there that most people are just totally unaware of. Let me explain briefly how caffeine works in the brain. And then from there, I'll explain this kind of insidious phenomenon that's going on that's really harming a lot of people's energy levels without them realizing it. So our brain basically has many different neurotransmitters that are either stimulatory or inhibitory, kind of energizing and awakening, or make us more tired and sleepy and relaxed. And it's constantly trying to maintain a certain balance of those. And that changes across the day. Is it daytime, the time to be awake, alert, and active and energetic? Or is it nighttime, right? We have a circadian rhythm that's regulating a lot of those neurotransmitters and the balance between them. But during the daytime, there's a certain balance that our brain's trying to achieve. Not too much activity, stimulating neurotransmitters, and not too much sort of low energy neurotransmitters. We don't want to be too relaxed and falling asleep during the day. So one of these neurotransmitters that's important in this balance is called adenosine. Adenosine is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, meaning it's relaxing, it makes you sleepy, it makes you lower energy. The way that caffeine, one more step. So we have this neurotransmitter adenosine, it fits into adenosine receptors in the brain, and when the adenosine fits into those receptors, it triggers that cascade that results in lowering our energy levels, making us sleepy. The way that caffeine works is actually on these adenosine receptors. So like adenosine, caffeine fits into those adenosine receptors, but instead of triggering the cascade that adenosine triggers, where it makes you sleepy and lower energy, caffeine just plugs up the receptor. So caffeine blocks the adenosine from getting in. So by blocking an inhibitory neurotransmitter that would otherwise be making you lower energy, it creates a stimulating, energizing effect. And that's all well and good, but the problem is this. As I said at the beginning, the brain likes to maintain a certain balance of those neurotransmitters. So when you do that on a daily basis, the brain goes, Oh no, we're being overstimulated. We need to bring ourselves back into balance. And the way that it does that is by increasing the number of adenosine receptors on the brain and increasing the overall amount of adenosine floating around in the brain. And the end result of that is actually what's happening based on those negative neurotransmitter adaptations that the brain is engaging as a result of being exposed chronically to caffeine. Basically, you end up lowering your baseline levels of energy when you're not on the caffeine. So this is a phenomenon that's talked about in the scientific literature. It's called withdrawal reversal. And what this means, this is actually pretty mind-blowing for people to think about this, people who are chronic caffeine consumers. We know that if we take, I'm going to kind of explain three layers to this. So if we take caffeine naive people, meaning people who don't normally consume caffeine, and we give them caffeine, they get a boost. They get more energy, they get better mental performance, cognitive performance, better physical performance. And we can measure those things and see those increases in performance by various ways of measuring that. However, that effect disappears within a few weeks, meaning if you take those caffeine consumers who have been consuming caffeine daily for a few weeks and you compare them to caffeine naive people who don't consume any coffee or caffeine, there is no difference in cognitive performance or physical performance or energy levels. And the reason why, the reason why that is because of exactly what I just explained. The brain engaged in negative neurotransmitter adaptations that actually lowered your baseline non-caffeinated levels of energy and mood and performance, okay? And that the one other key element to this that's insidious is subjectively, people who consume that coffee still feel like they're getting a boost from it. They wake up, they may feel groggy and tired, and then they start their day with coffee. And as soon as they get that coffee in their system, they feel like everything's turning on and awakening. And that's true, there is a subjective boost, but the tricky and insidious part is that it's actually not a real boost. It's a boost up to what used to be your level of normal function, cognitive and physical function and energy levels. And now you have made yourself dependent on an external substance just to function at what used to be your level of normal. So in other words, last thing I'll say to wrap this up is basically the chronic caffeine consumption has created negative effects. And then when the caffeine leaves your system, you get withdrawal symptoms. You actually have lowered performance, cognitive, physical performance and energy levels. And now when you take the coffee, you get withdrawal reversal. You are undoing the negative effects temporarily that the caffeine did to your brain. So you've, in other words, become dependent on caffeine just to function normally.
One of the things I've said on this podcast, and there's so much value there for people to connect with, is that, you know, caffeine is effectively a drug. And if you treat it, it's an amazing drug, best drug on the planet, in my opinion. I love my caffeine. I love my coffee. But yeah, it's a drug at the end of the day, and regularly removing it. Like for anyone that listens here that's into their fitness, into their particularly performance, I think for athletes, endurance athletes, bodybuilders, or even just competitive people training at a high level, having regular breaks from caffeine gives you all that benefit, so that when you reintroduce it, as you said, it just becomes your new normal and you only bring yourself back up to baseline after a certain point, and you're losing all the benefits of this wonder drug that you could potentially time to get all the performance enhancing boosting from it. I'm going to pull a part out of your book because you've given me a nice little segue there, Ari. You've broken your book into a couple of parts, but at the start, I think it's early on, it's chapter 1 or chapter 2, rewiring your energy clock. Talk to us about rewiring your energy clock.
And that was an excellent summary, by the way, of how to use caffeine properly. A lot of people get confused by that, and they think, well, are you saying caffeine's bad and I should never consume it? Or, you know, and what you said there is actually exactly what I would have said in terms of how to use it well. So the energy clock, we have a biological rhythm. It's called the circadian rhythm. And it's composed of two parts. We have a central clock in the brain, in a part of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that clock is critical for impacting on many, many different aspects of our physiology, from many different neurotransmitters, including things like adenosine levels, but also GABA, which is important in relaxation and calming the brain down at night, also dopamine and serotonin and others as well. Another one called orexin, which is a critical neurotransmitter for energy levels and overall wakefulness. It also impacts on a number of different hormones that are tied into this circadian rhythm, including testosterone, cortisol, melatonin, growth hormone, thyroid hormone, and others. They're intimately tied into this circadian clock. And several other mechanisms of how this is regulating our physiology, including impacting on mitochondrial function, impacting on the function of our mitochondria, which are our cellular energy generators responsible for producing most of the energy in our body. Now, we also have peripheral clocks. This is a relatively new scientific discovery, really has been built out mostly in the last decade. We have these peripheral clocks, in addition to this one in the brain, peripheral clocks in almost all the tissues of our body, specific clock genes that are in our liver and our intestines and our skin and our eyes and our fat cells and our muscle cells and our bones and basically every tissue of the body. And while the central clock is primarily responsive to the environmental input of light, also to some extent food, to some extent movement, and to some extent temperature, the peripheral clocks in our body are primarily responsive to the input of food. And the goal, if we want that whole circadian rhythm, which again is impacting on all these different neurotransmitters and hormones to help our physiology function well, to help us sleep deeply, to help us be energized, to help us perform at our best, to help our hormones be at our best so we're in a good mood, we have strong drive, good energy, good libido, all these things that we all want. If you want all of that to function well, you want to synchronize your central clock with your peripheral clocks. So we want to have light inputs into the central clock to get bright light within the first hour or first half an hour, ideally, of the day. We want to get as much bright light throughout the day as possible. We want to minimize artificial light at night by using the right kind of lighting in our house, ideally incandescents and halogens, by minimizing the output of blue light from screens in our house, from computers and phones and TVs, by using blue blockers, by using good lighting in our bedrooms and in our bathrooms and things like that in the spaces that we spend time in before bed, by blacking out by creating darkness in our bedrooms. All of those things, each one of those things that I'm mentioning very quickly there has a huge amount of research on it showing how powerful it is in optimizing physiology. As just one thing I'll mention there, melatonin is often known, people often think of it as like, oh, that's a sleep supplement. Well, okay, it's a bit more than that. It's a hormone, first of all, produced by our bodies. And it turns out it's actually involved in much more than sleep. Melatonin is the most important mitochondrial antioxidant known. And every night before bed and during sleep, our body is designed to create a huge surge of melatonin that's designed to saturate our body, saturate our cells and our mitochondria, and to help protect them from damage and to help them repair and recharge themselves every night. Well, we now know that as just one data point, just being in your home under standard indoor home lighting, fluorescent or LED home lighting, suppresses melatonin levels in most people by upwards of 70%. So most people are suppressing this critically important hormone for protecting their cellular energy generators by 70%+ every single night. Now, do you think that if you're doing that every night for months, for years, for decades, that you might end up accumulating some damage to those cellular energy generators? Like, heck yeah, you're going to do that. You're going to cause big, big problems. Melatonin is also vital for protecting the brain, for anti-cancer effects, and many more important effects throughout the body. So on a practical level, again, we want to optimize the central clock with the peripheral clock. So I just gave you some strategies to optimize that central clock that's primarily light responsive. To optimize our peripheral clocks, that's what I talk about heavily in the new book, Eat for Energy. And I talk about four specific strategies to do that. One of which is to optimize your eating and fasting windows. So most people, there's research been done by a circadian rhythm researcher named Sachitananda Panda. I love his name. And he's shown that in the US, over 85% of Americans eat in a feeding window, an eating window between 13 to 16 hours a day. And this is similar. I know you're in Ireland. This is similar in most Western countries. Probably not quite as bad over in Ireland as it is in the States, but similar. And we know from many, many studies now that that's way too long, and it creates problems. It creates problems in the same way that the central clock is disrupted by too long of a light window during the day, too much artificial light at night after the sun goes down, and our brain's not designed to have that light entering into that circadian clock. So by optimizing our feeding windows, and we want them to be somewhere between 6 to 10 hours, and where you are in that range depends a bit on whether you're a young, fit guy like Brian and I, for example, and you're doing lots of physical activity and you're healthy and energetic, or you are somebody who's much older and chronically fatigued and very overweight and not physically active. And so for a person who is fit and is very physically active, they might find what's optimal to be a bit longer, to be more like on the 10-hour side of that spectrum. If you're very sedentary, if you're not physically active and you're very overweight, you might find what's optimal to be closer to the 6-hour end of the spectrum. But either way, we know that rough span of 6 to 10 hours a day from your first bite of food to your last bite of food, we have several studies that have shown big improvements in insulin sensitivity, reductions in markers of inflammation, improvements in decreases in oxidative stress, and improvements in sleep and energy levels just through implementing that one strategy without even altering what you're eating or how much you're eating. Just saying to someone, I don't want you, you don't need to change anything about what you're eating. All I want you to do is just keep doing what you're doing. Just do it within a 6 to 10 hour window. Just that alone has been proven to have massive physiological benefits in so many different ways. So that's one of the strategies I talk about in the book.
It's interesting that over the last few years, and again, I've been in the space for nearly 10 years now, health, wellness, fitness, just as a nutritionist on the other side of the spectrum, body composition particularly, but that conversation away from what should I eat to when should I eat is becoming more and more prevalent. And it's brilliant because it plays such a role in just overall health, longevity, mitochondrial function, as you've said. And I know the book goes through it in a lot of details. It's really interesting as well that when people listen to the podcast, when you think about modern day, when it comes to the light in your house, to being eating for 16 hours while you're awake is so far away from ancestral times that people were evolved in. So you're fighting against your own biology effectively now, your biological hacking, hence the biohacking movement for the most part, because you're trying to go back to your basis, back to your roots. And I think a few of these tips, as you've mentioned, and there's loads in the book, are so helpful. They're small things that add up to big results when you implement them over time. You know, the 10-hour eating window, something I apply myself, the same with the incandescent light bulbs in the room, blocking out blue light, all things that have had a massive impact on me personally. With food then, Ari, I know you talk about energy superfoods, and I don't want to spend too much time on, you know, eat X, Y, and Z, because there's so much context, obviously, that people would need in order to apply what would work for them. But we did touch on the when to eat. When it comes to what to eat and eating for energy, as opposed to saying eat X, Y, or Z, can we start with what we should consider avoiding or minimizing, as opposed to completely demonizing entire food groups or brackets? But is there anything that people can consume or consume less of that would have a positive impact on their mitochondrial function and their energy levels throughout the day?
Yeah, of course. You know, I took a bit of a different approach with this book than most diet books. There's big financial incentives for people to kind of take an approach of saying something to the effect of, everybody's got it wrong. It's not low fat. It's not low carb. It's not paleo. It's not Mediterranean. It's not vegan. Really, the big, you know, the best human diet is this, you know, and insert wacky extreme human diet here, you know, that's claiming that the best human diet is one that avoids, you know, all kinds of major food groups. And the wacky ones are the ones that really tell you to avoid food groups, you know, that try to blame all of our woes and disease on food groups that, if you actually look at the nutrition science, those food groups are decidedly associated with good health and disease prevention. Unfortunately, some of those diets have been quite successful in getting lots of people to believe in this kind of nonsense. But I don't take an approach like that in the book. I'm not saying, hey, here's the one best human diet. Everybody else has got it wrong. Nobody knows anything except me. I'm saying, hey, I've been studying nutrition science for 25 years. I've accumulated a lot of knowledge. One of the things that I know is that there isn't one best human diet, but there are certain basic principles. One of those basic principles is get rid of the processed food. Eat whole, unprocessed foods. That is by far the most important rule of nutrition. And it and things that people have been obsessed with, specific food groups, is it grains that are a problem? Is it lectins that are a problem? Is it this food or that food? Is it carbs? Is it fat? Is it saturated fat? Is it this kind of carb, that kind of carb? All of those kinds of things are less than, you know, 5 to 10% of the equation. The 90% is the whole foods. And most, you know, arguably the most important contributor to our modern disease epidemics of obesity and diabetes and heart disease and cancer and neurological disease, most of the disease burden, these are 80% plus of the disease burden are diseases of lifestyle, not diseases of genetics. And most of that can be attributed directly to the switch from our ancestral diets, which were composed of real food, to processed food. So that is a huge thing. The book focuses on strategies that can be paired with any specific dietary pattern, everything from veganism to keto to Mediterranean to paleo to whatever you want to do. I'm not prescribing one specific dietary pattern. I'm giving you a collection of strategies that can be paired with any of those dietary patterns. And many of those dietary patterns are really good. And I would encourage people to adopt, to find one that feels right. You know, I personally eat something approximating, you could call it maybe some kind of mix between a paleo and Mediterranean diet. So, and I personally think, you know, based on my studies, that somewhere in there, those dietary patterns tend to be ideal for promoting longevity and disease prevention. But there's also a role for certain other dietary patterns in certain contexts. Let's say somebody's very overweight, maybe it's worth adopting a very low carb diet for at least a period of time if that's helpful in supporting their fat loss. And then, you know, so I won't go in deeper detail than that, but beyond getting rid of processed foods and eating whole foods, I don't think that there's a compelling case to demonize lots of other major food groups. I think most of that is cherry picked. Like, you could talk about, oh, soy is harmful because look at the phytoestrogens and this and that. If you actually look at the research on soy, there's a whole bunch of research showing it has clear anti-cancer effects and doesn't do many of the things that many people claim it does. Just as one random example, not that I'm advocating everybody to eat soy or something like that. You know, the same is true of grains. You know, the research on consumption of whole grains is decidedly in the direction of disease prevention, not disease promotion. The research on lectin-rich foods, for example, consumptions of legumes, decidedly, huge, very, very strongly in the direction of disease preventative. That you really have to distort and cherry-pick the literature to present a case that beans are some major cause of human disease. So, you know, there's a lot of nonsense that goes on in the diet book realm. I'm not engaging in any of that in this book. I will say, you know, I focus more on, hey, consume more of these things rather than demonizing various food groups. Eat whole foods, get rid of the processed junk. Once you've done that, I'm a big advocate of eating lots of plant foods, lots of non-starchy, fibrous plant foods. That's critical for supporting gut health and many other aspects of health. Gut health impacts on many different things. We have a gut-brain axis. We have a gut-mitochondria axis. We have a gut-lung axis, a gut-immune axis. So by supporting your gut health, you're supporting everything else in your body. It also, you know, doing that also has a big impact on helping us manage blood sugar levels. For example, and I'll mention blood sugar dysregulation is one of the biggest contributors to people's low energy levels. 80% of people in the U.S. have at least transient spikes into pre-diabetic or diabetic ranges of blood sugar levels. One third of adults experience hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, 2 to 5 hours after eating. And then another chunk of people have something called idiopathic postprandial syndrome, which basically mimics the same kinds of effects as low blood sugar levels have hypoglycemia. So blood sugar levels is this huge problem. And getting rid of the processed foods, consuming whole foods, increasing your intake of non-starchy, fibrous plant foods and having a diversity of them, and doing simple things like consuming those plant foods with a bit of vinegar on top of them, consuming them first in your meal before you consume the other foods, particularly any starches in that meal, has a huge impact on increasing insulin sensitivity and managing the post-meal spike and decline in blood sugar, meaning it stabilizes your blood sugar and therefore stabilizes your energy. So
is
the
that
book
because
is
of the fiber intake. Just out of geeking out now on my nutrition side, I have to ask, is that because of the fiber?
Yeah, the fiber slows down gastric emptying and also to some extent coats the intestines and impairs or at least slows down the speed of absorption of any carbohydrates that are present in that meal. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut across you, but out of curiosity from my side, you can continue on, but I had to ask that.
Yeah, it's a great question. And then the acetic acid from vinegar has multiple different mechanisms by which it's basically helping to lower blood sugar levels. It helps muscle soak up the carbohydrates from that meal much more effectively. It activates AMPK, which is basically a signaling cascade to sort of facilitate energy burning. And what, you know, what's cool is simple little tweaks like this, this one thing of consuming non-starchy vegetables first in your meal before you eat anything else on that plate there's research on this in diabetics showing that it lowers their hemoglobin A1C from 8.3% to 6.8% within a couple months, just from doing that one thing, not even altering what you're eating, just changing the order of what you're eating on your plate and consuming those veggies first. And then I should mention hemoglobin A1C is a marker of insulin resistance, basically a marker of how diabetic you are. And 6.8 is close to the cutoff of 6.5, which is non-diabetic. So just that one strategy alone of consuming, you know, fibrous, non-starchy plant foods first in your meals, just doing that one thing for a couple months almost made diabetics non-diabetics within a couple months. Now you start to add some other things in strategies in there, like add the vinegar on top of it, or lemon juice does the same thing. Eat the protein first in your meal too, which has a similar effect. So have the protein and the veggies first in your meal. Have some vinegar, add some cinnamon to that meal, and you know, a couple grams, 2 to 5 grams of cinnamon, and all of a sudden you've massively transformed your blood sugar response to that meal. And over time, you've massively transformed your levels of insulin sensitivity and reduced insulin resistance. So there's a lot of simple things like that, you know, and that's a strategy that can be integrated with everything from keto to paleo to veganism to whatever, right? So, you know, the book's really filled with things like that. I would say as far as specific foods, some of my favorite superfoods are I would say, if I'll list them off, I've been talking a lot here, so I'll just list them off briefly and we can talk more in detail if you want. But beef liver is one, salmon roe, salmon eggs is one, oysters are some of my favorite superfoods from animal sources, pastured eggs are another one, beets, pomegranates, chlorella, spirulina, berries, broccoli sprouts. Those are some of my top superfoods, I would say.
I love that. And for those who are listening that have body composition goals, weight loss, fat loss, keeping those blood sugar levels stable throughout the day is absolutely key for adherence to a dietary strategy alongside keeping energy levels stable. If you think about it logically, if you're riding this energy roller coaster, it makes dietary adherence very difficult to stick to. So if you can keep that nice and balanced, keep the energy levels stable, it means that, you know, everything feels easier. And again, a lot of it, particularly with body composition, is how you're feeling and how you're adhering to what you're doing. You also talk about supplements in the book, and I won't spend too long on this, similar to the food question, but there's a couple of supplements in there that jumped out at me. But I'm curious, from your standpoint, Ari, what's the one, and again, a Pandora's box of a question, what's the one supplement everyone should take? That's not the question I'm asking. But what's the one supplement that, when you started to do the research for, or even applied it in your own life, that you've become a massive fan of?
Yeah, well, there's a number I would put in that category. If you want me to just say one.
No, you can name a few. You can name it, because I know some of them bounce off one another and they're complementary to one another, so feel free.
Yeah, okay, so I'll mention a few briefly that have really impressive research in the context of fatigue specifically. Rhodiola rosea is one herb. The research on it is really pretty mind-blowing. It's almost hard to believe some of the studies that have been published on this. There are studies where they've taken people with stress-related exhaustion and fatigue, and they've shown that it can cut people's levels of fatigue, levels of anxiety, levels of brain fog in half in a week. In 7 days of taking this supplement, you cut those things in half. To cut your energy levels, to cut your fatigue in half, is basically the equivalent of saying you're doubling your energy levels. Another one is acetyl L-carnitine. Probably many people listening will have heard of that, but the research on it's very impressive in the context of fatigue. There are studies with older adults with chronic fatigue where they've shown 40 to 60% reductions in scores of mental and physical fatigue within 2 to 3 months of taking just that one compound.
Can I park on that one for a second? Just because I'm a huge fan of acetyl L-carnitine. I actually have that as a fat burning supplement in my last book, because I love L-carnitine. I know it pushes fat cells in the mitochondria to be burned for fuel. Mm-hmm. Why is it that it has such a positive impact on energy?
Well, it's basically helping mitochondria burn fat for fuel. The acetyl group, also feeds into the citric acid cycle and helps energy production there as well. But I think the majority of the effect is from facilitating beta oxidation of fatty acids. And there's also an antioxidant effect at the mitochondrial level that's also going on there. So there's a lot of good stuff going on.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut across. That was another one that I had to ask out of my own curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely. Your questions are great. I would say, if I was going to mention, well, I'll mention a couple brain supplements, because often these brain-related symptoms, depression and anxiety, typically overlap with people with chronic fatigue. Lion's mane is something that's been shown to reduce depression and anxiety by 30-40% within a couple months of using it. And I'll mention saffron is one that that most people typically don't talk about or think about, but saffron is very impressive. And there's numerous studies that have shown it to be as effective as antidepressant drugs in combating depression, but without the side effects. So that's an amazing one for brain-related issues. And the last one I'll mention is another one that people never talk about, but it has incredible research, is NT factor phospholipids. There's a paper by a researcher named Garth Nicholson. It's called Lipid Replacement Therapy. And it talks about how this specific phospholipid formulation can actually get digested intact, make it into the bloodstream, and then get delivered to your cells, to your mitochondria, where it helps repair damaged mitochondrial membranes and facilitate more optimal function of those mitochondria. There are studies in older adults with chronic fatigue showing that this restores their mitochondrial health to that of healthy 29-year-olds. There's numerous studies in people with chronic fatigue from various causes, whether we're talking chronic fatigue syndrome or obesity-related chronic fatigue, or old age, age-associated chronic fatigue, or even things more obscure things like Gulf War illness, chronic fatigue. And the studies consistently show that between 4 to 12 weeks of using just this one compound increases energy levels by 30, 40, 50%. And there's numerous studies to back that up. And it's amazing to me that not more people know about it or talk about it. But yeah, those are some of my favorites.
That's interesting you say that, because I'm quite heavy into the research myself and I haven't heard about that. So as soon as this podcast is over, I'm going to be checking it out. I'll also link that study in the description for people. Ari, we have covered so much here and there are so many golden nuggets. And for those who are listening, I highly recommend, if you're struggling with energy levels, we're singing from the same hymn sheet. Like, sometimes I like having conversations with people with different opinions, but long-term listeners know we're so aligned with the eating for energy and what I'm hearing from you on looking after your sleep, your circadian rhythm, making sure that you're eating mostly whole foods, reduce your processed foods, add in the supplements that can help your mitochondrial function. There's just, we just unpacked bits of the book here today. Like, there's so much more that people can check out. For those who are listening, where's the best place for them to pick up the book? Can they get it anywhere online, on Amazon, or anywhere else you want to send them? Ari, please do that now.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brian. The book comes out May 10th. It's published by Hay House. It's going to be everywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, anywhere that you can buy books, but certainly it'll be on Amazon. Go grab the book. It's packed with amazing information. I mean, what I've shared here is really just 1/50th of all the strategies you can learn in this book. And it's really non-dogmatic. It's flexible. As I said, it can be paired with any of your existing dietary patterns. You don't have to be intimidated that you have to adopt a whole new specific extreme diet or something like that. And you're going to learn literally dozens of strategies that have science to back it up that are going to dramatically improve your energy levels, your hormonal function, your neurotransmitters, your gut health, your brain health, and so much more, all within 30 days. So go grab the book on Amazon or wherever you want to buy it.
For those that are listening, I will link everything we talked about in the show notes. And just to give a little bit of context, because I have a lot of listeners who read my last book, The Keen Edge, Mastering the Mindset for Real Lasting Fat Loss, which is probably the height of the compliment I could give to those who enjoyed that book. This is the energy equivalent of what I wrote in mine. Mine was all about weight loss, fat loss, how to make different diets work for you, get your mindset right. This is the energy equivalent of that. So if you're struggling with low energy, you want to get that fixed, you don't want to have that dogmatic approach, this is the book to read. So go check it out. And Ari, thank you so much for writing it. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for all you do. And I look forward to catching up again soon.
Thank you so much, my friend. And I want to say one last thing. I rarely say this. I do a lot of interviews, but I want to say that I'm very impressed with you. You inserted great commentary. You were excellent with, you know, formulating really questions that followed the conversation really well. And you know, I wasn't familiar with your work prior to this, but I'm going to start following you because I'm very impressed with your interview skills. You did a great job.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, it's very easy when I'm passionate about the topic and you're putting out that work. So that works both ways. So thank you so much, Ari.
Yeah, and you have a lot of knowledge. Like, I can tell, you know, even though you're restrained, you didn't share everything you know, but I can tell the commentary that you did insert, you really know your stuff. So I'm very impressed. Just wanted to throw that out there. And I don't say that often, but I wanted to throw it out there for your listeners. They're following a good person.
Well, a compliment 100% accepted. Thank you so much.
There you have it, functional medicine expert Ari Whitten on eating for energy, how to beat fatigue, supercharge your mitochondria, and unlock all day energy. So much in today's podcast episode. I definitely think it might be one that is worth going back and listening if you're someone who struggles with chronic fatigue or general fatigue. And as I said in the intro, if you have any family members or friends who are struggling with this, please pass on the podcast to them. I think it's one of these episodes. I do one every 50, 60, 100 episodes that can really have a positive impact on people's life in terms of bringing awareness to what they can do to enhance their quality of life if they're struggling, particularly with something like fatigue and energy levels. So please do that. Hopefully it will help those. And if you are someone in that boat, hopefully you got a lot of value from today's podcast. And if you're like me, who's just looking to increase your own knowledge and education around how to optimize your energy levels through the day, hopefully you got loads of value too. That's all from me for this week. Catch you all next month. Monday.